Welcome to Door to Door Insider, where we take a deep dive into the mindset, the why, and the how of the industry's top entrepreneurs, leaders, recruiters, and salespeople. We are the Door to Door Nation. Here is your host, Lee Barber. Let's go.
All right, gang. Welcome to Door to Door Insider Season 4. Today's special guest is Pete Gutierrez. Pete has been in the sales industry for over 20 years. In 2009, he ventured into door-to-door sales with alarms with Pinnacle. In 2013, he expanded his experience to the solar industry, working with Vivint Solar in South Bay, California. Pete is currently with Legacy Power in accelerated growth and is a proud father of three daughters and enjoys staying active by running, surfing, and snowboarding. He has a passion for continuous learning and reads over 30 books a year. Additionally, Pete engages in day trading as a side hustle. Pete, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
I'm excited for this one. You've been with Legacy for how long?
I joined the tail end of December.
So I had the first opportunity to meet you up at corporate, and we went to meet a guy that you had brought in just to talk to him. And you started talking about recruiting and training decks and processes. And before that moment, I was like, my training's good. My training's pretty good. You know, we do 2 days of solar school for an hour, and we get them in and we get them on board, and we have, you know, all this stuff that we do. And the moment that I heard you say everything that you said, I was like, man, I got a lot of work to do. So it's a pleasure to talk with you today. And I just wanted to do that little intro because you were impressive to me right off the bat. So usually the way we start is a brief history of, you know, what early childhood looked for Pete kind of growing up. And then you said you started in car sales. So we'll kind of get into that. But early years for Pete, what's like a kind of brief outline of your family, brothers, sisters? I don't know much about any of that.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Lee. So early adolescence. So, you know, I was raised by a single mom, a great mother. She did everything she could to provide for us. Wasn't around often. So I am the oldest to, out of three. So I have a sister that's exactly 1 year younger than me. My brother's 5 years younger than me, really close to my brother and my mother. And, you know, growing up, I spent a lot of time playing sports. I think for my mom, it was much easier to put me into sports, pick me up after school. And, so I spent a lot of time with coaches.
Sports were the babysitter.
Yes. Sports were the babysitter. It's probably the best thing that could have happened for me because I have a lot of energy. I've spent the last decade of my life really trying to figure out how to calm that energy and actually put it to focus. Mm. But when I was young, I couldn't do that. And so having coaches, in my face and constantly trying to, you know, get me into shape was probably the best thing I could have, experienced as a kid growing up. The second part to that was that I did grow up for a small stint for about 4 years in a small farm community, before moving to another smart.
Where at?
So this one was in the border of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. It's a place called Touche.
Okay.
It's a really small place. Yeah. And we were in the middle of nowhere, like no houses around for miles. And, at that time where I was being raised, the father figure in my life, I would say at that time, was a ranch hand. So he worked on the farm. And so I was put to work immediately, from like the ages from 9 to about 11, 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And so waking up really early to do irrigation pipe before school, going to school, coming home, working on the farm. And in the summertime, that's all we did. So learning the entire process of what all the effort you put in the springtime, you maintain it in the summertime, and you reap that in
sowing
the fall.
The fields.
It was really huge for me. And then also, on the farm, you had to be really creative, right? Because you were miles away from everything. So whatever's in the truck, right? Whatever you have on hand, like you got to figure it out. And so problem solving became one of those early things, that I was introduced to. But one of my most pivotal moments, growing up, was meeting this guy named Chris Wagner. He was actually the owner of the farm. And, his two sons had came back from where I didn't know at the time. And I had asked Chris and said, hey, like, you know, where did your sons go? And, you know, why are they back now? And he explained to me that they went to college. This is my first time ever hearing about college, you know, really young, 9 or 10 years old. It wasn't something that was really spoken much in my, at least with my mother. And he said, no, they go to school. He's like, they go to school. And I said, cool. What do they do when they go to school? He's like, well, they're going to school and they're going to come back and run the business. And I said, okay, so what's running the business? He's like, this is running the business. And so he started walking me through and I said, wait, okay, so you go to school, right? You get an education and I can come back and run the business. And so this is where my
mind. How old were you when this was going on?
Right around 9 or 10 years old, right? So this is my first time being introduced, like, oh, wow, there's something more than this, right? Which was the struggle and.
You can run the business.
Yes. And that you can run a business and that I could be in the truck, drive it around, right? Yeah. AC on. Yeah. And that, you know, there's a lot that I learned in that experience working on a farm. And to this day, it's a big pillar of who I am, but it didn't round me as the character and the person that I was meant to be, but it did teach me the value of hard work, right? And that you have to endure the process, right? Because it's a long process. Like waking up at 2 a.m. in the morning because I had the smallest arms to help put my hands up a cow's ass, essentially, vagina, I should say, and then put the chains around the hooves to yank it out because it was stuck. And just learning these things. And
birthing,
and,
man, it's a serious thing.
Birthing's situation. A serious thing. Yeah. And the circle of life there and enjoying the moments, it was really pivotal for me growing up because it's exactly what I needed because I didn't have a father figure growing up. Yeah. And so being around other dudes and seeing how they worked and how they spoke with each other and how free I felt, like to this day is probably one of my most pivotal times of my life because it was the foundation for, you know, my hard work.
I love that, man. It's interesting. You have kids and you know, you don't want to mess them up. And I've got, my daughter's 12. I have another daughter. She's 22. Really rough time when I was younger. So thank God her mom raised her at that time. But I've had this second opportunity with my second daughter, Lotus, my youngest. And, you know, I really didn't have her doing much, really up until like last year. And she would, I'd be like, let's do swimming. She's like, nope, don't want to. And I'm like, let's do volleyball. She's like, oh, absolutely not. And I'm, you know, and she would just kind of game. And, you know, I do therapy and my therapist is like, you're parenting out of guilt. And it was an interesting thing for me at first. She's like, what? Like, no, I don't have, she's like, it's guilt of, you know, how you grew up and you're trying to create this really like soft life for your daughter because you don't want her to experience what you experienced, but she's not in that type of home anymore. Right. And then I went to Tony Robbins and you hear this stuff like Joe Rogan's like, soft men make hard times and hard men make soft times. And, you know, I went to Tony Robbins and he's talking about the world and the planet and the current state of affairs. And he's like, generationally, I guess stuff Tony studies generationally, what the generations prior to us, like X was one of the last quote unquote harder, like callous, more callous generations. And what X forward has done is we're creating this soft people. And all of that really caught on to me. And, you know, like it just clicked and I'm like, no, we're going to the gym. We're going to personal training. You're going to softball. And just the change that I've seen in her over work ethic and how like genuinely she appreciates me. Cause she'd be like, I hate going to the gym. I'm like, no, you don't. And we get there and I'm like, how was it? And she's like, I loved it. And she'll give me these hugs. And it's like seeing that work ethic implemented into her. And that's our job as parents. It's really cool that you had that experience because, and it's like, for me, I've had to learn how to do that with my own daughter because, you know, I'm a hard person. I'm hardworking. I'm, you know, great morals, ethics, great work behavior. Like I'm constantly like, it's hard and I come from a hard place. And so I was in the midst of that, like trying to create this super soft, cushy environment for my daughter so she could be rewarded and not live the life. And I was just hurting her. And when I instituted that work ethic and those hard things, it was like instant change and just her attitude and her figure and her team build, just everything. There was so much that went into it. So that's, I love that, man, that you had that. And it's like, it's interesting for me to hear that. Cause I'm like, man, that's what I'm trying to teach my daughter right now. And as parents, it's hard, man.
It's really hard. I struggle with it every day too. My kids had a cheer meet yesterday and the weather was awesome. They just wanted to hang by the pool and they started griping about going. And I said, look, you know, first off, when we start something, we're going to finish it. Mm. But two, this is how I start every run, which is I don't want to do it. But when you finish, it's going to be the most rewarding thing. And they got first place and they were super stoked on it. And the funny thing is the weather changed, right? So they wouldn't have been able to go to the pool anyway. And that's just life, right? Life is just trying to get going. And just that's the hardest part has always been for me is get going and getting momentum.
Yeah. It's this weird thing, right? Like it's, you know, this, what is successful people do what they need to do, not what they feel like doing.
That's exactly right.
So cool, man. And then teenage years, what did that?
So teenage years, I ended up moving to a small town called Payette, Idaho when I was 12 years old. And that's where I spent the rest of my time going to school. Very, another small kind of community, bigger than the one I lived in prior, right around like 4,000 to 6,000 people. Graduating class was right around, I think, 74-ish, not a big class. And so a lot of sports, because if you were athletic, fast, and all those things, you played every sport, multiple sports. So I really gravitated. I'd always played baseball, and football was kind of my main thing. And then when I got into middle school, picked up basketball and soccer. And soccer became my main thing, where I played year-round from seventh grade all the way through high school, which was cool.
So some of that competitive spirits in there too.
Yeah, I was able to win a state championship on that one too, which is pretty cool.
Nice,
man. Yeah.
So 20s, where do we start moving towards the sales career?
So that's a really good. So I didn't want to do college. I went to college, tried it out, and I just could not focus for whatever reason.
You have attention deficit?
I do, yeah.
Me too.
At a very young age.
A lot of us do.
Yeah, at a very young age, and I've gotten much better at it. I mean, at that time, I just could not. I'm like, squirrel, anything, everything I wanted to go after, and I could not just focus.
Yeah.
You know, so my buddy was like, hey, I know you're in school, but you should try selling cars in the summertime. This is before, you know, everybody's buying it on apps. You know, they had to go on newspapers. Yeah. And I got really lucky because there was two Bosnian guys that ran the car dealership, and they taught me how to sell. And they taught me this concept, which has always stuck with me, was that show don't tell was the thing they would always say to me. And what they meant by that was that there was a lot of words. You could say a lot of words through the presentation, but if you can get them to actually do something, that creates like that energy and that attachment. And so they would do this thing where, hey, if you can get somebody to go in the trunk and close it, you know, we'll do a $500 spiff. And I did. I walked them around. I used all the techniques they taught me to get in the car and all this other stuff. And I said, hey, look, there's this handle in the back. You should try it out, right? Because it glows. And they were like, whatever. I was like, I promise. And then they went in and they did it. Everybody was laughing. But what I learned through that experience was that I don't know what I don't know. These guys have a lot more experience. And to me, it felt that this is goofy and like, is it really going to work? The reality is when you try these things, they do work. Mm. And another thing they taught me, which was really good, was that just don't assume what they want and ask a lot of questions. Mm. So this is where I learned the discovery questions of, you know, being able to not profile somebody when they come on the lot, right? But to ask a lot of questions. Just because it's a guy looking at a sports car doesn't mean he's there to look at a sports car. Mm. For all we know, he could have a family and looking for a minivan. Right. Yeah. And so you need to ask these types of questions, really good discovery questions, to then build a profile around this individual. And then while you're doing that, simultaneously, you're looking, thinking of all the cars on the lot that could fit this person so that you can really, you know, do an option close between the vehicles. So those two concepts really helped me, kind of start my search for becoming a better salesperson, right? Because then I realized that I was really good at it and making a lot of sales, that like, this could be something, right? Like sales could be the way out without having to get a degree and go in that direction. So I went all in on it.
You know, I've talked about this book on the podcast a couple of times, but there's a book called How to Survive as a Hunter in a Farmer's World, Attention Deficit Disorder. And so they really specialize on, like, you know, so many studies have been done on children with attention deficit, but not so much on adults. And I think really, like, you know, we're all growing up now. So when I was in school, it was in the '80s, and I was in special ed, because they didn't, in, you know, 85, they didn't know what attention deficit order was. It was like, I remember getting spanked for, I also have dyslexia, but because I can't spell and I still can't, you know, so it's like, but what this book does is it talks a lot about the adult with attention deficit and the hunter mentality. And what they say is that it's actually a mindset that has come up through evolution. And it is the hunter, because the hunter needs to be able to pick something up or kill something and then drop it in pursuit of the next best thing. And so our minds are constantly on the move. And it was small tribes of people which is where we started, it was always what's coming. And right, in our minds, we'll also, we do a lot of negative self-looping and some of the, what could be the worst case scenario, or what's this, or planning or plotting or just hunting. And they talk about how applicable our skills are to the sales world and what a double-edged sword they can be if we don't hone them in right. And I really vibe with what you said, because it was the same for me. I still struggle with it. And we were just talking about time management. I have to really be very careful, because I'm like, I hate doing this thing because it's really hard for me to sit there and do it. So I break it up into chunks specifically. But on the sales end of it, like doors for me were like, oh, this is the hunt. Like, yeah. You know, people are like, doors. I'm like, I don't know. I kind of like doors, man. I would just like go out and I was just like hunting. But really good book. I know you read a lot of books. Yeah. It's How to Survive as a Hunter in a Farmer's World. Some really good explanations. And it kind of normalized me. It made me feel like, oh, okay, it's all of us. We're like a tribe of hunters is right. What it is. And what they said was the farmers came in, and farmers are like my wife, Misty, where they have to be able to plant crops, have patience, wait over time, pull all, you know, and then it's like, so it's a completely different mentality. But when I read it, I was like, okay, I'm normal. So
yeah,
I vibe with that. Yeah. So the car sales, do you go, what did you go into doors? 2009?
Yeah. 2009. So in college, we had a really close group.
Did you go right from cars to doors?
I didn't. There was a little bit of a lapse where I tried a few other sales jobs, you know, worked in a call center and tried a few other things. Learned a lot about cold calling at a young age. So I was trying to figure out where I wanted to land with sales. Yeah. I wanted to find something that had really big commissions. I didn't like waiting for ups at the car dealership, and I could see that it was turning, in that industry. And so a really good friend of ours named Oscar Luna, give him a shout out.
Oscar Luna?
Yes.
So what year was this?
So he's been part of our friend circle since the early days of college, so like 2004.
Wow.
And so we all have this group, we're all still friends. And, he went out that first summer and came back. And I remember he bought a Hummer, and I was like, what are you doing, bro?
What was the product he was selling?
Alarms.
It was alarms.
Yeah. He went with, to Seattle with Apex, which nice. Is now Vivint. And then every year he was taking out my buddies. And then I saw him buy a duplex, and I saw him buy more. And I was like, he was accumulating wealth at such a young age. And, we loved Oscar, but there was this one thing that like, we all thought like Oscar, like if Oscar could do this, like this is insane. But yeah. One thing he taught me is he has probably one of the hardest work ethics I've ever seen in my life. Like he is not afraid to go out there and get into the trenches and go grow. And I love that about him.
Yeah.
And so he brought us all in, into the industry, and I didn't want to go out and do a summer sales program. I loved being at home. I love my summers. And I'd spent, early on, the whole reason why I took, these sales jobs is because I took all winter off to go snowboard. I love snowboarding. I would every year put anywhere from 80 to 120 just on my tags. I loved it. And the whole point of me getting into the summer program was so that I could do that. And ironically, that didn't happen, which is so funny. But he brought us in. He started his own shop in Boise called Zenith. And he had this office, and it was the first time I ever attended a sales correlation. He had a bunch of people in there, and I was like, this is cool.
This is back 2004, five-ish.
This is actually back around 2009-ish. And then after that, I experienced it. We went to Wichita, Kansas, and then started learning how to sell door-to-door. And I really struggled because I missed home. I felt that for whatever reason, knocking on doors felt like it was a little beneath me for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people feel that way when they first get in. And I was in Wichita, Kansas. We were knocking in the middle of winter time of all times, still getting sales. But I gave my car to my buddy, right, Tyler, and I was dropped off in Ariat. And I had what is called a curbside moment, is what I call them, where I'm sitting on the fucking curb and I'm like, what am I doing with my life?
Yeah.
Starting to think of all the other things I could be doing besides this to make money. And so there was a shopping center close by, about a mile. So I walk. And I go into this Barnes & Noble, I grab a Starbucks coffee, and I sit down, and it happens to be a self-help section. And I haven't read a book at all. Like even in high school, college, I didn't want to read books. It's not my thing. And I said, I'm here, I might as well read a book. And the first book I grabbed was by Dale Carnegie, How to Stop Worrying and How to Start Living. And I opened it up and I couldn't stop reading it. And I had this epiphany that there are people out there that have lived an entire life and they put all of their lessons into a book. I said, how beautiful is that? And this is where I learned the concept of daytime compartments, right? Like the Titanic, where it was designed to, if it had a hole in it, was to shift the water from one tank to another, mm-hmm. to another and push it out. And essentially how to manage your emotions and your thoughts and all this, and taught me the concept of what's the worst thing that could happen right now. And just keep doing that and doing that until you get to the moment is, are you still alive? Mm-hmm. And if you are, then go push forward, because the worst thing that can happen, you've already imagined it. So you can choose whatever outcome you want. So just go put your effort towards something and go all in on it, because either way, one of them is going to happen.
I love that.
You know, so.
I love that. It earmarked that for a second. So I love timelines. You know, I think a lot of, I remember when I started with Vivint in 2017, I was 41. And, you know, my initial thought was, it was Justin Mott was one of my buddies. He's here in Vegas. He works for Pros. Great dude, amazing salesman. And he, you know, he was coming around with these checks and I'm like, door to door sales, bro. Like, that's below me.
Right.
I sell limos. I'm like, right. Like I worked in business development, a limo company. So I would just, you know, get contracts for large corporate transportation. Like it's some like, you know, magically amazing job. I'm making 110 grand a year. And, I went into a recruiting meeting and, you know, off I went and I made it. But I often think about the times of if I would have not done it or if I would have quit at any one of the times along the way. So I just like to talk for a second about, you know, the curbside moment and you not quitting. You know, your current reality is literally the equivalent of that choice and a million macro choices along the way to continue doing hard things. So I wanted to earmark the Barnes and Nobles, but just kind of talk about that for a second. Like, you know, looking back, like the not quitting, what were those processes like? And, you know, cause we see guys come in and they quit and there's so many guys that have quit and I'm like, man, I wonder what your future would have been like. I wonder what your family's life would have been like. I wonder what you would have learned. I wonder who you would have led, who you would have inspired that you just never did because you quit when it was hard and didn't do it. So yeah, just talk on that for a second, the not quitting part.
Yeah. So, you know, for me at that moment, what I was realizing that it wasn't the job. Mm. It was me. And there was something inside of me that wasn't okay. And that's the thing about this job is that you will learn more about yourself than you will about the job. Mm. Because in that moment, I said, look, it's not this. It's not going out. It's like, what are you afraid of? Are you afraid of rejection? Are you afraid of failure? Mm. Are you afraid of what people are thinking of you? There's a quote that I repeatedly always say all the time, which is, you are not what you think you are. You are what you think people think you are. Mm. Right. And this concept of me creating this story and this image and what people, and the reality is just go to work because it's all work. Like if I go back home and I decided to go work back at a car dealership or work in a call center, I still have to call people. I still have to engage with people. I'm in sales. Like I have to create some sort of traction, a pipeline. And for me, in my mind, I said, look, this is the easiest way to build a pipeline. Mm. I know they're homeowners. They live there. I can talk to them versus all these other ways to do it. And so in that moment, I just said, hey, look, just commit to it and just commit. Don't think about it again, but use this as an opportunity to get better as a person. And I was in and out of this for up until I got into solar. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until that last summer I did in Texas leading up into that solar, getting into solar, that it really clicked for me because I wasn't really mentally, I wasn't built for it yet. Mm. And
it's like the farm though, isn't it?
It is.
You're not built for it until you build yourself into it.
That's exactly right. And mm-hmm. the biggest thing was that I didn't commit. Mm. I never committed. Like I would always commit for a day, maybe for a week, but I wouldn't commit long-term. And how I knew I wasn't committed long-term because my actions weren't showing it. Mm-hmm. Like I was out partying and hanging out and, mm-hmm. and doing all the things that I want. Like I still wanted to have this awesome lifestyle, but then like still like not doing this.
Not.
Right. Yeah. And I couldn't balance it. And some guys could do it. I couldn't. And so the reality is I didn't know myself well enough. I didn't, I had too many blind spots that I wasn't aware of. And I didn't have a good enough circle of people around me to call me out on my bullshit. Mm. And that's the best part about having a family is because Like when you have a family, it's every day you see it, right? But in that moment, I didn't. And so I started really trying to figure out, like, I need to surround myself around better people. I need to be around people that can call me up, that can hold me accountable. More importantly is, what's my self-image of myself? Mm-hmm. These were all the things, like the discovery that I was going through at the time, which was over not just a week, but years. Yes.
Isn't that the magic of doors, man?
Yeah.
It really is. Like, this industry is like this. If you stay in it, I mean, there's probably people that haven't done much evolution in the industry. I don't personally surround myself by them, but this thing is like this. It's excel or die, like spiritually and mentally, right? It's like, and it's like you said, like, what's the worst thing that's going to happen to me today? And I go, you know, like you, we go through these ups and downs, like, what if the world, you know, now I have these sandbags and I'm like, if the whole world crashed apart, if I have a polo and a phone and a neighborhood,
right,
I can go out and make $50,000 this month just by myself. Just give me a product. And like, and that's where in my mind today, when all of this stuff and everything, I'm like, I'm highly skilled, and there's a lot of comfort in that, but developing into that was years of self-doubt, self-deprecating behavior, talking bad to myself, comparing myself, which is the worst thing to do because I'm just not like anyone. Comparing my numbers, comparing my income, comparing my house, comparing my work hours, and so I'm just not this and that. And meanwhile, I'm working through it and pushing through it. My family's life is changing. My life is changing. My economics are changing. My spirit's changing. My intellect is changing. My physicality, like everything's changing with it because I never quit. And that pressure cooker, that pain of like becoming better, it really is. It's like, you know, waking up at 2 a.m. and having to go birth a cow and then, you know, doing hay and this and that. Eventually you know how to be the guy in the truck.
Right.
If you just stay on the farm long enough, you don't have to go to college.
Right.
You can just learn how to run the farm and eventually you'll be the guy in the truck as long as you don't quit doing the farm work. And so I really vibe with what you're saying because I went through a lot of it and my therapist has helped me over the years reframe things. And one of the things she was like, you know, imposter syndrome. And I always would say that.
Yes.
She'd say, stop saying that. That's fluff.
Right.
You don't feel good enough to be in the room. That's you. That's a you problem. Yeah. You don't feel worthy. You don't feel good enough. And so you have to ask yourself, why don't I feel good enough right now? Because it's like you're saying, people will be on doors or doing whatever they're doing and they get overwhelmed with a thing. Like, what's the worst that's going to happen? An old lady's going to answer a door behind a screen with a chihuahua in her arm that won't quit barking at you. Somebody's going to answer the door with a gun behind. Like, nobody's ever been shot.
Right.
Like, you're going to be fine. Power through it. So I love that, man, because it is this lesson of just like, find a way not to quit. And while you're not quitting, fail forward. So I love that. So back to the Starbucks. There you are, not quitting, reading Dale Carnegie. Like what does it look like from there?
What it looked like from there was that, okay, let's make a decision and let's move forward with it. So I made a decision that I was going to stick with the door to door until I figured it out. And I was going to find a way to make a living off of it. You know, making these decisions in the moment is like the easiest thing, mm-hmm. at least for me, right? It's the easiest, like you're super stoked, you're pumped, yeah. right? And then you wake up the next day.
And you gotta do the thing. Yeah. You're like, oh man, I made a self-commitment. Oh,
every day you make a commitment. Yeah. And that's why like I just didn't have a good enough circle. And what I realized was that I needed to get out of where I was at. And this is when I parted ways with Oscar and I actually met a guy named John Frampton through a friend of mine named Steve Moreau and was introduced to the summer program. And I went out to Philly that first year.
Frampton was with Vivint, right?
No, we were at Pinnacle at the
Pinnacle.
Time.
Pinnacle.
Yeah.
Frampton's name is familiar to me.
Yeah. John Frampton. Yeah. And that was a very interesting experience for me.
What year was that?
Oh, shoot. 2010 or 9.
Got it.
It was a while ago.
Yeah.
And we got shipped out to, we stayed in Cherry Hill in the towers. However, we knocked in Philly. I'd never experienced culture before in my life. I grew up in Idaho working on farms. And then all of a sudden it's like, it's like a drizzly over cloudy day. And I have an iPad and I'm dropped off in West Philly.
Yeah. Have like, fun.
Yeah. Have fun.
Bye, kid.
Oh gosh, talk about learning how to sell quickly. And what I found out is that all human beings are all the same. We all have our, you know, we all aspire for something. And if you can just connect with somebody, that's the big thing, is just connect with somebody and build trust with them. They're willing to hear you out and to give you a chance, right? But when you're working door to door and you're doing alarms, like, you slip up just one bit, like, you lose all that trust. They don't want to deal with you. And so that's why I loved alarms so much, because it really was like a pressure cooker. Like you said earlier, like, within a few minutes, you're in the home and you're using all these gimmicks to get inside. And then you get inside and all of a sudden there's a technician knocking on a door 45 minutes later. And you're like, holy smokes.
Yeah.
I want my next kill.
Yeah.
And it's just like the next one and the next one and the next one. And I was not the best guy. Like, I would fund 150 in a summer. I was not your best door to door guy, but I felt like I was pretty steady Eddie. Like, you know, I was pretty good with it. I felt that I figured out how to make money in it. But, you know, I was surrounded by, you can learn from great leadership and from poor leadership. They're both great learning opportunities on what and what not to do. I learned in that summer, we ended up losing most of our team because it was just poor leadership. And I remember I didn't want to be a part of it. Everybody bailed, but I decided, I said, hey, I made a commitment to stay here. I'm going to stay for the summer. And then I went to a postseason in Atlanta and met a bunch of other guys that were getting ready to take off to go do solar.
Was it still? So not with Pinnacle anymore.
This was with Pinnacle, but everybody, we were getting ready to transition over to Vivint, to Vivint Smart Home for alarms.
Yep.
And everybody was starting to talk about, hey, there's this thing called solar.
Yeah.
Right. And so I was on the East Coast, happened to be at that time. And there were some guys that were going to go start along the Long Island office. And they're like, you should come. And I was like, I would love to. Sure.
Let's do it.
And John's like, no, you're not going.
So what does it look like from there?
What's interesting is that John was really good. He was my leader, my mentor.
Where's Frampton at now?
I'm not sure. I think he's running his own solar shop now. You know, he's been
in. Did he ever go to Vivint?
Yeah, we all went to Vivint and we went to Vivint Solar. And then he took off to go to Solar City and start that whole thing.
I've heard his name before.
And we went to Texas, and this is a very interesting thing. I don't share this very often, but when I went to Texas, I probably said one of the best things was that John put me in this office. Like, I wanted to be around the guys that were going out on weekends and having fun, like, you know, kind of a lifestyle thing. And John's like, no, you're going to be in this office with a bunch of return missionaries. And he did. He put me in the same spot as Mace Sorensen and a few other guys. Mace Sorensen is a huge pivotal part of my life and how I shifted. And in that summer, I started going to church with these guys and I started being around them. And there was this energy of sobriety, of, you know, being sober.
Spiritual sobriety.
Yeah, spiritual sobriety and also of substance and all this. And I was like, what if I just didn't
do anything,
fuck around for 3 to 4 months? What would that look like? It happened to be my best summer that I had. And more importantly, spiritually, I was like, okay, there's more than this. And I didn't go home to Boise after that trip. And I never went back because there was too much at home that would tempt me. And I wasn't strong enough yet
to do
so it. I stayed isolated.
I love this topic, man, because, you know, I'm in recovery from, you know, alcoholism and drug addiction when I was younger. I actually don't like to identify specifically as that anymore. I just based on not anchoring myself to the past. Like, I really define my sobriety today just in the sense that I have such a big purpose. You know, I have my daughter is my purpose. My wife is my purpose. My teams are God is my purpose. I have a bigger purpose where, you know, alcohol, cigarettes, drugs, they just don't serve me. So yeah, I was, you know, definitely alcoholic, and, you know, I don't even pretend to be able to drink at this point. Like, it's not something I want to play with, but I really love that you say that, because I think that, you know, I see a lot of different stuff in the industry, and guys, and I don't judge guys,
right? Like,
meet them where they're at. I don't have any room to judge anybody, but I think there is something to be said for mental and spiritual and physical sobriety in the cleanliness of your mind, body, and spirit, how you process emotions, how you process yourself, and how you grow like at 1% better, right? We're just trying to grow this. I think it accelerates that growth and it compounds. You know, there's a thing that they do say, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's meeting life on life's terms. I don't know if it's the only place that it's said, but it's something that's always stuck with me. It's like, whatever's going on, I need to meet life on life's terms, and I need to do that sober. You know, and I see people with their kids and sometimes they're drinking. It's not generally bad, but it's like, you're also not the most present father or mother you could be in that. And, you know, you drink tonight and then you Sunday and you wake up Monday, and it's like, you're not the most physically, mentally, spiritually present person in that. So I don't judge people. I do find, that I'm attracted to people who have more sobriety in their life, just mentally and spiritually, because there's some type of connection there where you abstain from, you know, finding this reason to check out, right? And it's like, I get it. It's fun and all this stuff. And it's, I get it. But there's something to be said for the strength that comes in not needing to check out, not using that for fun. Cause it's like, creatively, I don't drink and I have a lot of fun. I don't do drugs and I have a lot of fun. So it's like, I really connect with that, and I vibe with it. And again, I'm not judging anybody for drinking. I always do challenge people. I'm like, just like you said, try it for 90 days and see how you feel. See what your relationships look like. See how your work looks like. See how your intellect looks like. See what the books that you've read, the content that you've taken, how you're approaching life, how your physicality is. Like, just try stopping. And this is the other thing. Can you?
Yeah.
And most people aren't alcoholic, but they can't stop drink because I can't miss out on Friday night with the, and it's like the can't, that's a problem. Like when there's a can't, when you can't, to me, that's a problem. So I vibe with that. So you connect with all these guys. And what year is this? This is
in 2012.
This
is right before we go
solar up. In its infancy.
Yeah.
This
is right in its infancy. And I was approached, you know, I'm from Boise. So you have Jason Newby and you have all these guys that are been building really big regions out of,
Newby.
Boise. Yeah. Yeah. Solid dude. Yeah. Never worked with them, but he was always trying to get me to go to Hawaii, and I wanted to go. Yeah. He recruited me probably like 2 times.
He looks like somebody who'd be in Hawaii.
And I and John every time was like, no. And I'm so glad.
I didn't know Newby's been around that long.
He's a lot of us are like, holy smokes. I see guys at conferences. I'm like, dude, we're old as hell now. Like,
oh, geez, man.
Oh, geez. You know, getting that's in dope. Your 20s, I'm about to be 40. And so, but yeah, you know, going back to that summer, I was very grateful to be around really good men. Mm. You know, I think that for me, not having a father figure in my life, I don't know what I don't know. I had nothing to model off of. Yeah. So a lot of times I'm guessing and so forth. And YouTube wasn't that big at the time. Like, kids have so much opportunity with the internet mm-hmm. compared to where it was at when we were growing up. So there's a lot of mentors. Everybody could be your mentor on the internet, and you could anchor onto a lot of really good, solid dudes out there. And for me, I didn't. And so being in that office was so beneficial to me. Like, being around Mace Sorensen, being around Tanner, being around Parker, these such like pure dudes, no agenda. They just want to be your friend, hang out. Like, I'd never been around that before in my life. And it really helped me and turned me into this next 7 years of my life, where I met my wife that summer, you know, end up having, you know, our 3 beautiful children. And, it was all due to that one summer. And that's where, like you said earlier, you know, what if I would have given up? I wouldn't have my kids today.
Yeah.
Who knows where I'm at? And that's life. Like, life will always push you in the right direction as long as you just commit and you just say, I'm going to go all in on this. And mm-hmm. so that summer was huge for me. I set goals. I said, I'm going to go do this, and I did it, and it felt really good. And so leading up to that then was going to solar. I hit up John and said, hey, I'm going to go do solar. And he said, great. So are we. So awesome. And then, so we go to the Bay Area, and, man, solar in its early days was
tough.
it was tough, but it was fun.
Yeah.
And ignorance is bliss, because when we came in, we just expected that you would do the same numbers.
What,
as
was it PPAs, loans? What was it back then?
It was
then?
All PPAs.
It was
the leases only company.
Probably. Well, leases back then, right?
Or no, was it was a PPA.
It was a PPA.
And, we had no idea. Like, our training when we came, we just, okay, well, let me take a step back. So we just assumed that, you know, we could do the same solar numbers, right? I mean, the same numbers in solar as we could in alarm. So you should be able to do 1 of 3 a day. That's mm-hmm. what we figured, because if we were taking people from, you know, $25 to $60+, this is a no brainer. We're saving them money, right? It's free solar. Yeah. Like, in our mind, we're like, this is like incredible. And our commissions doubled. Yeah. Like, in today's world, everyone is so spoiled, right? Because the commissions are so high. But back then we were getting paid $200 a kilowatt and a majority of our money was coming from CAD pay, which was like $75 a kilowatt. So we got a lot of CAD pay. By the time we got the install pay, there was really nothing left, but like it was interesting. But I was very grateful for it because we did some serious volume and I had a lot of really good people in my office, like, you know, for John Frampton, Trevor Bybee. We had, you know, Luke was in our office, you know, CSO. Luke Toon came in our office afterwards. And we just had so many hitters in our office.
Is that where you met Luke?
Yes, that's where I met Luke. Luke came in after John Frampton left and became my DM with Brian Rossetter. And it was really good. I loved the experience.
How was Luke?
Beast. Luke is a beast.
He's a beast.
Yeah. And I happen to be the guy for whatever reason. This is my skill set, which is I'm able to watch people do something and I'm able to turn it into a training. That this is a skill set that I have. I could do it with a lot of things. The way my mind works is I'm able to look at it and break it apart and say, okay, we can teach in these different ways. And then they should be able to pick up for the majority of the people, 70% of people, they should be able to pick it up fairly quickly. And this is where in my office, I think it was Luke was just like, wait, do you hold like trainings on Wednesday? And I'm like, yeah, I do. And he's like, why? I was like, because everybody keeps asking me. And so I just figured I'd just host a training. Yeah. And, but when we got in, the beautiful thing about getting into solar at that time was that we were just given paper contracts and we were working in San Jose. Our office was called South Bay, but San Jose, California, it's like the tech capital of the world. Mm-hmm. And everybody there is, you know, working at Google, working at Apple. Everybody's an engineer. Everyone is like, the culture is really diverse and the cultures in, you know, in cells are, they don't make same day decisions and, and so forth. And most of these houses don't have AC, so they have low usage. And they're like 1.5 million and today probably $2.5 million small little ranch houses, like 1500 square foot. So it was really interesting to get there because it was really hard and it had been plastered for years on the loan product. A lot of canvassing teams, a lot of like Varangos and Solar Cities and all these companies that had been there for many years. So when we got in, I was excited. I can speak for myself. I was really excited. They got this new product. I was studying all the equipment on the airplane ride to find out that none of that mattered. Right. And so I was like, so what's the product? And they're like, just there's a paper contract had all these pages in it. And you know, you'd have your folder, same technique as alarms where you tear it and you don't show it.
It's a fold out.
Yeah. And so you write 15 cents in there and you write 2.9 and then have them sign it and then have them sign like blank page 37 of like a NAM, like, okay, done, let's go. Right. And so the crazy thing about this was that when we got in, what it was this, okay. So when we got in, we were selling them, but we had nothing to show them. We didn't have a CAD design. We didn't have a monthly payment. We didn't have any of this stuff. So we had to figure out how do we get people to sign up same day and commit to a site survey? Because that was the key. So we used the same techniques as alarms, like conceptual pitch really quick, get them to understand that, hey, this isn't buying solar panels. This is just buying electricity from a solar company. We just happen to produce the power on your home, right?
Same thing we're pitching today.
Same thing we're pitching today, full circle. And the crazy thing is once you got into the home, I had this NEM pitch that I would do with them to get them to understand why solar existed. And then we would transition into, you know, the paperwork. And they would always say, well, how much am I going to pay? Well, we don't know until we get somebody to your house. And so, and that was the process.
I cannot even imagine.
Yeah.
That.
And, but the crazy thing is we would sign 2 to 3 of these a day.
Yeah.
Like Luke would throw down 20 of these in a week. It was insane.
Luke just went out and sold just to knock doors. This is our CSO for anybody that doesn't know. Chief Sales Officer, Co-owner of Legacy. He went out, was it like a month ago with Mark and sold 4 in a day.
Yeah.
He's still a beast. He's a monster. But anyway, so.
And these were all self-gens.
Yeah.
Because there was no such thing.
No setters.
There was no setters in this world. And so as you eat what you kill, you had to go do
when
it yourself.
I started back in 2017, I had never heard of a setter.
Yeah.
This is like, well, that was alarms. And then 2019, that's when I started Vivint Alarms 2017, 18, 19. I went to Vivint Solar. Nobody had setters that I was exposed to. Like the setter thing to me is pretty new, like last few years, like 20 and above. But anyway.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about that because in California, that's how they all did solar.
They did.
That's how all the companies did it. And I'll tell you how I reverse engineered that later on. But what was interesting was that we learned how to sell the product conceptually. Mm. And we realized that the real product wasn't solar panels. It wasn't any of that. The real product was long-term price protection. Mm-hmm. We knew that the rates were going to grow exponentially. We had the data on it. There was a report that came out. The utilities wrote what was called the death spiral.
Yep.
It was based on data in Germany about how utilities essentially just don't become profitable when people go solar, which means the grid can't be maintained and so forth. And so I researched a lot, I studied a lot and tried to find an angle to really pitch these homeowners. And this was it. It was a conceptual pitch of, hey, we would sell you this power if we could. If we could produce this power in a field and ship it to you, but all the cost is built into delivery, mm-hmm. which is how we, you know, we built Payne and did that through this, the bill discovery, right? Or kill the bill. And so we would get homeowners to sign up and they would have to basically sign this paper contract. They would have to sign a blank NEM contract. We'd have to do a full credit check. They would need to do a welcome call to confirm that they were signing up for 20 years just to schedule a site survey. Which we were so backed up because guys yeah. like Luke were crushing it and we didn't have a lot of surveyors. So we waited 2 to 3 weeks for a survey sometimes. And then we had to wait another, and then CAD at that time got so backed up. It was like sometimes 6 weeks before we could go back with our actual CAD design. Jesus. Like forget about it. And also keep in mind, Vivint at that time did no re-roofs. We only did comp roofs. We did no MPUs.
So talk about
everything was 44 to 50% offset. Almost every system was. Wow. And so we had to learn this other concept, which is getting homeowners to understand that buying some electricity at a discount is better than buying it all at full
being
price.
Being a little away from the devil's better than being yes. away with him. I'm just sitting here thinking, doing math though. I'm like, dude, if you're in California and you signed up at 15 cents with a 299 escalator back in 2011, you're crushing the game right now. Those dudes, they're at like 51 cents out there.
Yeah.
You're still doing good. Like that's, but this is what you're pitching is you're pitching the long-term, like,
yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah. So anyway, yeah,
that was super good. And, had great leadership. I, one of the pivotal parts for me having a great year that year, you know, starting with, you know, being there with Vivint Solar and then transitioning over to Legacy with Luke and Doug when they started the company was that, you know, Luke was probably one of the best leaders I was around because he wasn't like your traditional leader where he got you super excited in front of the room and all that. He was really good at delegating. And then he was really good at going out there and showing you. Slanging it is all I needed to see. Mm. And so he stood up in front of a room one day. I've shared this story many times throughout my career where he said, hey, anybody that wants to follow me on Find My Friends, he's like, add me. And I did it. I was like, cool. Awesome. Let's go. Mm. And he would, as soon as the meeting was over, you could never find Luke to go to Chipotle or to grab lunch after he was gone. He was in Hood. Mm. And, that created more urgency of me like, okay, I need to get out more. I want to be good. This is the top guy in our office and the company. This is what he's doing. I need to mirror that. Mm. And then one day he calls me and says, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, no, just chilling out in the area. And he, you know, kind of quizzing me a little bit. And he's like, no, you're not, dude. I can see it. I forgot I had added my friends. And it was funny because at that moment I was like, gosh, man, I let myself down. And I let him down. I didn't let him down. To him, his life goes on.
Yeah.
But I let myself down because I made a commitment that I would, you know, go all in on this. And my actions were proving that I wasn't going to go all in on it. Yeah. They had this incentive at that in during, I think it was 2013, which was, or 14, if you do 100 installs in that year, you would get LTIP. Mm. So I was shooting really hard for that.
Vivint LTIP?
Yeah. This was back in the day, way back in the day.
Yeah, if you could have kept that though.
Yeah.
That would have traded nicely.
Yeah, for sure.
That liquidity event was a good one.
That was a really, really good one. Yeah. So, but yeah, that's essentially where I was at. And so I was really spent a lot of time perfecting my becoming a rep. Mm. I wanted to be a manager. Like everybody wants to be a manager. At this point, I had been in the industry for quite some time. I was helping, you know, run some offices and assisting, but like never earned an override because the culture back then was that you don't earn overrides on anybody, right? Like you need to go build your own team if you want to earn overrides. Like I'll help. You can help me with my team. Great. Mm. But you're going to gain the experience. At least that was the culture I was a part of. And so when I got into solar, they used to do this open invitation or open application process when they launched a new office. And so I would apply all the time, but I would never, you know, do the interview process. I would never get hired. And I was like, I want to be a manager. The reality, I wasn't ready for it. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I was ready, but people that were watching me knew that I wasn't ready.
It's weird because you're talking about this, and I mean to interrupt, but someone earmarked that, the interview process with the office. But I feel like we have a lot of reps running offices in That's the industry, very true. In the industry. And it's just like the military, right? There's a Marine and there's somebody in the Army, and then there's a Navy SEAL or an Army Ranger. There's a difference between grunts and operators. And it's like, you know, I had John Taylor on a while back, and he said the problem with our industry is that people make so much money so fast, they think they're a professional, and that can really start to hinder people's growth because, you know, and when I see people get in and they're not actually operators, like they don't understand the macro details of everything that can happen. They're making decisions, not knowing what's going to happen a month, 2 months, 3 months down the line. There's a lot that's missing in there. And I think some of that has, you know, left the industry where what you're talking about, where there's like, no, you're actually not ready yet. You need more time. This is what's going on. And I think the reason that some of that's left is because there's so many choices now. A guy can just get a hair up his ass, and he's like, you know what? I'm not a manager. This dude over here is going to give me 5 extra cents, and he's going to call me a district manager. Right. I'm ghost. And instead of staying in the saddle and doing the hard things and learning things and watering the grass where they're at and like learning the lessons with people that, right? Because generally you're in an office with somebody you love, trust, respect, you know, and they'll leave and think that they can do it and go try and put those shoes on. And I've seen people try and put those shoes on, not just in my house, just in general, in the industry. And I'm like, you're not wearing the shoes well, man. You are, you know, you playing the playbook for ruining a team, playing the playbook for ruining setters. And, you know, we're in this industry, we're recruiting. We have a fiduciary responsibility to people's lives. We're making people generally quit when we're bringing them in from another job, we're making them quit their normal life. We're saying like, hey, let's get out of this 9-to-5. Let's get out of the matrix. Come in here with me. When you do that, their life is, they're trusting you with something to teach them something new. And if you're not an operator and you don't know how to grow that human, change that human, and how to lead the team in the right direction and not get everyone killed or ruin the team or just ruin people's lives. And sure, you can sell, but you have people's lives in your hands. And I see a lot of that where it's just people are not, they're grunts. They're not operators and they're in offices and yeah, they're making good money, but they're not making great decisions. So I think there's a lack of it, man. But so that was cool. They were just like, no. So what did that do? But I almost already know the answer. So they told you no, but that has to just gear you to, okay, I don't know enough. I need to know more.
Yeah. So I felt that I had really perfected the process of being able to sell. Mm. And then second was that I figured out how to train people. So, and I knew this because every time I was knocking, I would always have somebody knocking with me. Like my managers would be like, hey, I'm going to throw somebody out there. Awesome. And they would knock with me and they would always go back and like, I'm doing this job because I made it look so easy, yeah. But there's a lot that goes into it, right? Yeah. There's a lot of experience and so forth. And so I was like, good. And then my mentor said, you know, you need to learn how to recruit.
Yeah.
You need to go recruit your own team. Recruit. And I was like, how do you do this? Like, cause what you do is you like, I've already tapped into my network. Mm-hmm. I'm in California. I'm from Idaho. Like nobody's gonna want to move down here to try this new thing. I was trying to get Oscar in it and like trying to get a lot of people, but I just wasn't there. I didn't have enough oomph like behind my name to recruit people in.
Yeah.
And so, I asked Doug and I said, hey, Doug, I want to learn how to recruit. Could you tell me? And
Robinson?
Doug Robinson, CEO of Legacy where we're at. And he said, hey, look, the next time I'm on a recruiting call, I'll just patch you in and just put you on silent. And he did this many times for me. And I gained a lot from those conversations and I figured out what the pattern was. Like, okay, this is a system on how you recruit.
It's a sale.
And that really opened it up. And then this is where I started to come up with the concept of top, middle, and bottom of funnel because I was really good. Like you hear this all the time with reps, right? If you put me in front of a homeowner, I can close it. And it's like, well, then put more homeowners in front of you. Well, you know, I don't want to go do the hard work, which is generating, knock the door to get the lead, right? But put me in front of somebody. And I was that person, but with recruiting, I'll put somebody in front of me, I can recruit them. It's like, well, go find your recruits.
Yeah. Go generate the lead. That's the value add.
Mm-hmm. And so this
marketing is always the value add.
It is a value
always. Add. You can have the best product in the world. You can be giving away free gold bars. And if people don't know you're giving away free gold bars,
yeah,
nobody's going to come get free gold bars.
Yeah. You need to know who's raising their hand.
Yeah.
Right. 100%. And a lot of times, you know, you got to create that situation to where when they come across it and they raise their hand, right. Then you need to go do what sales does, which is how do you convert that over?
Yeah.
Right. And that's the entire middle and bottom process to it. And so, you know, when I was there at Vivint, it was very chaotic. It was just growing and everything, but everybody was scattering. Like, it was so interesting because Vivint at that time, and I just wanted to sell. I wanted to be at one company. And then I was part of like my region with John and other people where they were bouncing from Pinnacle, and then they went to Vivint, and then now we're at Vivint Solar, and then now they're going to Solar City. Mm-hmm. And so I was caught in this thing where, like, I've now learned this, but like in early on in my career, which is, oh, if you want a better opportunity, you need to go to a different company. Mm. Right. And so I ended up going and starting with these guys at Legacy and doing very well there, and started to figure out how to recruit top of funnel. One of the really cool things I like about Doug a lot, which is at the core of my leadership, is that the first thing he ever did was he hired a culture coach, which is Travis Anderson, I believe is his name. And he was with us for 4 quarters, and he had done this same coaching sequence with working with, you know, Utah team that went to the Final Four, working with the Broncos when they went to the Super Bowl, but really kind of really getting clear on what culture is by design and not by default. Right. Mm-hmm. And so in this process of going through this with Legacy, we were introduced to a guy named Todd Straw over at Grant Cardone. Mm-hmm. And he was recently there. He was their director of sales over their call center. I think now he's one of their VPs. He still works there. He loves it. And he introduced me to a concept. Well, first off, when he gave his speech, they do this all the time where they send in their guy to your thing and they do this whole spiel, but the whole goal is to get you to go to their 10X growth con or whatever it is, right? But he had recruited 1,100 guys into Cutco in 1 year. And I was like, how do you do that? Yeah. And he's doing it in the Inland Empire where I was at now and building teams. And he taught me this process, which was called cart dev, and how you actually pitch somebody in this process to get them to commit. And then more importantly, how do you get them up and going to make money as quickly as possible? Mm. And I was like, wow, this is incredible. He probably doesn't even know it. Like, to him, it was just like, oh, cool, this is what you do, right? But I took so many notes. I still have them. I still review them. And this is where we figured out this thing back in 2015-ish, is that these new hire events that we would do once a week. And he was like, I was like, well, how do you get people to show up to him? And social media wasn't that big back then. Like, it's so crazy how much you can use social media today to grow your brand and to grow all that. And these are all things that I want to do better. And you can see a lot of guys in the industry that really leverage this and they're doing great at it. But back then it was like, okay, cool. We had a big stack of flyers. We would flyer every parking lot we went to. We would, the day of the event, we would go to like the outlet malls because nobody wants to work at an outlet mall.
Yeah, it's true.
And getting people to come in.
Yeah, you see those people in the middle of the mall?
Yeah.
Like in the little stands?
Yeah, nobody
they don't want to work there, dude.
Nobody but wants to be there.
Also, all they're doing all day is asking people to come over to their little stand.
Yeah.
And they just get the worst looks, but yeah.
And they're built for rejection already. Mm-hmm. And so we learned this concept of, hey, let's load up the room every time. We built this deck. And this is where we learned this concept of getting people to buy into the industry first. Mm. Then buying into the vehicle that can take them to their destination in the industry, which was our company, and then how they make money and how we're going to train you better than anybody else and make sure that you're going to have success in this. And so we started growing and we grew really fast there. And then this is where kind of I got introduced to the setter closer model. Everybody was doing it in California. So Varango was a really big company in California that went out of business, but Varango, Solar City, and I can't remember the other company that was out there, but Peterson and Dean. Phenomenal. Everywhere you went, there'd be these vans of just tons of setters, just like scattering everywhere. And so I applied to, I applied to every setter position that was available in California. I went to all their recruiting interviews, their meetups. I went through the hiring process, not hire, actually get hired, but like I wanted to see how they were doing it. And then I reverse engineered it and was like, oh, this is how they do it. This is how they pay their setters. This is how they get people in and so forth. And I built a business plan around this. And then that's when I transitioned and went to the East Coast. I wanted to go back and work with an EPC. And so I went to Trinity Solar on the East Coast. And that's where everything changed for me as far as how I approached building and scaling from what I would say one of my most important mentors in my life, Tommy Pollock.
So this is where you know, our relationship began was me hearing, and just to unpack for the guests a little bit. So Pete's, you'll explain it better than I, but the basic philosophy is that there's, it's a funnel system, and there's three portions to the funnel. Top of the funnel is, you know, however many fishing lanes you have in the water to pull a recruit in, whether that's organic recruiting, marketing, flyers, you know, any lead source that you have to pull a recruit in, that's your top of funnel. How do you expand the top of funnel to get as many people in as you can? And then middle of funnel is the recruiting process and, you know, the on, like recruiting, onboarding, and then bottom of funnel is the training process. And where I've really learned a lot, well, I've learned on all three portions of the funnel from you for recruiting. But immediately what I determined was that you're right. We have to have, and I didn't, you know, we created these decks that you have and all these training platforms. But if, you know, we're spending XYZ on top of funnel, let's call it a couple, $2,000-$4,000 a month on bringing recruits in. Okay, great. We got them all in. Oh, and let's say we're spending a bunch of sweat equity in middle of funnel, and we have, you know, high value individuals, meaning people, mental, spiritual, physical, financial, high value individuals doing the recruiting meetings. That sweat equity actually translates into actual hard financials because they could be doing something else. And then you drop all those people in with no training. Yeah. And they don't know. It's like you just wasted all the sweat equity in the middle and all the financial equity on the top. And so what I really learned from you was like, oh, wow, first let's expand how we're getting people in on the top of the funnel. Let's get as many fishing lines in the water as we can get. And then two, let's really work on the recruiting process. Like, what does the interview process look like? And then three, the moment we met, I came home and started, I don't know if you know that, I left Utah. And I had my little notepad, and you were in a recruiting meeting.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I could ask you questions. You were just saying stuff. And I was like writing on my phone. I'm like, oh shit, this dude's dropping nuggets right now. Like, what is this? Top of funnel, middle of funnel, training deck, 4 days of solar school, three. And I like instantly came home and started, and like my whole team, I'm like, everybody's got to meet Pete. We're changing everything. And they're like, what? And I'm like, I'm making decks right now. Like, what? And they're like, solar school is 4 days a week. And I'm like, yes, it's 4 days a week. I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. And it's really worked, right? We're just in the kind of, you know, I'm a month into this with you and getting things dialed in, but it's a beautiful system, man. So it's really interesting for me to learn how, where you kind of learned it. So you reverse engineer it, go to all the things, and then you kick it into gear yourself. What does it look like from there for you?
So I go to Trinity and I'm a door-to-door guy. And so they give me, I meet with Tommy Pollock, he's meeting with my wife and, you know, moving from California to out there, and Josh Williams is presenting the opportunity for us. And Tommy's like, come here, I will teach you the business. You know, I'll teach you the corporate side of the business and the whole thing. And I was like, I could really go for this. Like, this is my career path. I shared my goals and dreams with him, and I really trusted him. And so when I came in, you know, his company was doing maybe, I don't know, 1100 installs a year, to now they just hit over 110,000 installs. To think about, not even 9 years ago, they were sitting at right around 4,000 to 5,000 installs as a company. But they had been an HVAC company since 1991. They had all the recipe, just missing a couple key components, which I believe that, you know, the team that was a part of that growth, we all contributed to kind of like, it's like a beehive. Like, we all just kind of had these ideas, and it was such a, felt like a startup, but it wasn't. And so I had asked him one question. I said, what's one thing that you've always wanted that no one's ever been able to build for you? And he's like, a setter model, setter close model. I was like, oh, that's really easy. I actually have the business plan for this. And that's the funny thing about life, right? Is that, you know, a lot of times you're preparing for something, but you don't know what you're preparing for. Mm. You think that you're preparing for a certain opportunity and it doesn't work. So you're like, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
But then the opportunity will present itself because it just, that wasn't the right one. Mm-hmm. And so I did. I sat in a room and he said, okay, write a business plan together. A lot of people don't know this, but he said, put a business plan together and you're going to go pitch the board. Have all your numbers go. So I shared it with them. He's like, okay, change this, change that. Boom. I go in there. They drill me on all these numbers. And I knew because I went through the process and I was in California and I understood what these companies are doing. So I felt that I was really prepared for this. And I was. He said, cool, awesome. And then the next line, he said, great job, Pete. We left the room. He said, great job, Pete. now who's on your team? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you can't do this by yourself.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa. Because my entire life, everything I've just done has been by myself. So he's like, cool, you need a Salesforce team. So Bonnie, here's Bonnie, da, da, da. They're going to help build out all the analytics and everything you need. Cool. You need a data analyst. We pulled somebody out. He's like, cool, you need an assistant, executive assistant to take all these notes. Here's Alex. And, you know, here's the traditional guy that knows how to close appointments, because appointments being handed to you are different than knocking on the door. And then also we need a call center so that the call center can do all of this. And so in that process, I started building this out on the back end, and we built everything, the tech, the stack. And so I learned a lot about how, because a setter closer model isn't just getting guys to knock on a door and getting an appointment. It's that's not it. He taught me quite a few things, but I remember when he said, whoever has the leads controls the game.
That's right.
And I was like, you're absolutely right. And he says, two is that you have to see the setter program as a marketing. It's just a lead source, Pete. There's acquisition costs that I have to pay, to whether it's, you know, top of funnel, getting them in, the training that we have to pay for, the training, the software, the tech, all that stuff is accumulated to every sell that we get, that when once we put them out on the doors. And so we had the privilege of having vans, we had the tech stack built out. And I remember went to Christian Calabuso and was like, hey, I need to borrow somebody. I think Brandon's the right guy for it. And we started it with Brandon, this small guy. And everybody fought it on the direct side because, like, how do we manage territory? How do we do all this? It's like, look, guys, it's going to work. And over time it evolved and it became its own thing. And it was really cool to be a part of it in the very beginning, because it really was that car drive going down to Atlantic City with Tommy and just asking him that one question. What's one thing that you've always wanted that no one's ever been able to give? And because I asked that question, I was able to add value. More importantly, I started understanding the entire life cycle of what a lead does. And I gained a lot more responsibility of overseeing, you know, from the call center to ad spend to other things like that, that I was exposed to, that I was like, oh, wow, this is managing a door-to-door team is a business. And I'd never seen it that way. I'd never seen that, hey, if you have 20 guys on your team, and if you guys, like, how many leads do they generate a day? Just people that rose their hand on the door and said, I'm interested, but bad timing. Well, I don't know. How many of those actually convert to an appointment? How many are on the appointments every single day? That was one thing I learned, was every day is, what's your appointment count? How many more can you add to the calendar that day? How many demos did we get that day? What was the outcome of those? Because if we sat inside the home, then we need to know, based on raw and scrub percentages, of where are we at? Because if we're below these thresholds, we're losing money. So I started learning all these things, and I was like, what an advantage. Like, if everybody could just know this, like, the industry would be so healthy, teams would be so healthy. And there's a lot of room. The thing about solar, there's so much room for everybody to grow into. It's what I've learned for many years being in the industry. But that is the key thing that I take away, is that we should always run it as a business. And if you're not running it like a business, you're leaving a lot of meat on the table. I mean, on the bone. But yeah, that was my experience with Trinity. And I love that company because of that.
I think this is, you know, it's like, I go through this with, listen, I still learn, right? It's like, when we were in that recruiting meeting and you said, I felt like, you know, I love feeling like a rookie. Like, I'm not right. How long have you been in the industry? 2009. You started selling in 2009, right? Like, I came into the door to door industry in 2017, right? And then worked as a rep for 2 years and then ran a small dealer. And then, you know, here. So, you know, in the comparison, you have so much more time under your belt, right? And it's like, that's why I love witnessing people who operate at a different level, who have gone through different, because really a door-to-door team is a business. And the difference between a grunt and an operator is an operator runs a door-to-door team as a business, right? KPIs are fundamental. I'm just going through some stuff with, you know, some of my teams now where they stopped posting numbers every night and they weren't doing that. You know, they were going to change some stuff, and then what they were going to implement just stopped. They just didn't do it. And then you see production downtick, and it's like, because there's no accountability. And it's like, you know, teaching guys over, it's just the same thing, right? It's like learning to become a farmhand. It's like, over time, we teach guys how to be an operator if they just stick in the game. But it's having them go through these experiences where, you know, a lot of what I talk about with my guys is it's like we are meeting people at all different kinds of levels of their career. A lot of the people that come in just lack a level of personal maturity, you know, even in their 30s and 40s sometimes, because they've never had to manage themselves directly. They've always gone and clocked in somewhere. And it's like, you know, they can't go out on doors for 2 hours because, you know, the world is falling, right? They don't have the maturity to stay out there. And so it's like you're trying to meet those people. And what I find is that some of the biggest things that we can do are the KPIs, is give them structure, show them, hey, this is what's happening. If you're doing this in 3 hours, if you doubled that and did 6 hours of that, you'd actually get these results, or knowing who's doing what or who's not knocking any doors, who hasn't knocked a door in. There's people on the thread that haven't knocked a door in 3 days. There's four doors. It's like those, let's talk to those people and bring them up or let them go. It's like, but having the KPIs, running it like a business. Setters are, it is a business and they are a marketing force. And guys think because they're putting sweat equity that it's not, there's no finance to that. Sweat equity is actually, and then on the top of the funnel, we're spending money to get those guys in. And then there's gears, and then there's time, and then there's training. It's everything that you said. This is one of the things that you said early a few weeks ago on one of our trainings. You were like, this is there, it's a marketing force.
Yeah.
And if you simply like, so like my roofing company, my Google pay-per-click campaign. I mean, the thing can cost, you know, some months, just the pay-per-click campaign, not the SEO. The SEO is about $5,000 a month. The pay-per-click campaign, which I had to stop because it's Napoleon said, I need horses, right? I don't have enough roofers to roof all the roofs. The roof, I think there's a poem in there somewhere, but it's like, you know, when I look at my pay-per-click campaign, I run KPIs in my pay-per-click campaign because most of my customers in the roofing company are either coming off my organic post, my Google certified post, or my pay-per-click campaign. And I have to put a lot of time and effort into that to make sure that everything's clean. Are my stars clean on Google? Is my insurance clean? Like Google wants checks and balances for all these things. And then what is the marketing? Are we doing, like, my marketing company does blogs and all these different things on my PPO campaign and my SEO campaign. Those are hard dollars. When I'm running in full force and there's $10,000 a month coming out of Fortitude Roofing's bank account into a marketing campaign, it's really, really real. It's $120,000 a year. You're like, that's real. People don't look at the setters like that. And the setters are that. They're a marketing force. And then there's a duality to it, because the more attention you pay to them, the better they become, and the better their lives become, the more they know. So it's like, I really love that theory of like running it like a business.
You know, to add on to that is that, you know, if you're spending, for an example, $10,000 a month and you're marketing on social media, you're going to make sure that that ad is working. Does it have the right sales copy? Do I need to change the picture? Do I need to do this? And you're constantly A/B split testing it because you're putting a lot of money out and you need to have some in return because CAC is important in running the business. And it's the same thing with the same concept with your ad is your setter. Mm-hmm. And so, hey, let me hear your pitch. What are you saying? Where are you being stuck at? And one of the main things that I learned and why I started training people on my own is because I'd ask, hey, where are you getting stuck at? And they didn't know where they were getting stuck in the pitch. So it was like, hey, you know, I noticed that a lot of guys were throwing around, hey, there's five steps to a pitch. This is what it looks like. And everybody has different variations of the five steps. And I was like, cool, we need to systematize the steps. So I read a book called Predictable Revenue. This is when I had to build out the inside sales team for Tommy. Mm-hmm. And I called Todd and he was there. I said, how are you running your inside sales team at Grant? He said, read this book. You'll learn everything you need to learn. And I was like, wow, this is incredible. Why wouldn't we just do the same thing with our setters and our just our reps in general, which is how do we create predictable revenue? How does McDonald's have the same consistency in fry across the entire world? It's because they have SOPs. Mm-hmm. SOPs are at the foundation of every business. And you should have those standard operating procedures in your office. And so what I started realizing with training, and this is something that I won't take credit for, but I learned from a kid named Andrew McCall at Trinity, and he systematized the training and he figured out a way to train self-gen reps in 5 days to where they can go produce. And I was like, this is incredible. Now, the content I was like, well, I would change this and change that, but that wasn't what was important. It was the system in which he put in, and he knew what the outcome was going to be. If I can get X amount of people into this training, I can get X amount of people to get out, and I can get X amount of production out. And I was like, this is incredible. Mm. And then, you know, Elon says, hey, you can take 3 weeks or you could do 3 days, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, he's absolutely right. So with training with reps is that you can spend 3 weeks banging your head against the wall, right? Like them calling you sporadically, oh, I'll knock with you this day, knock with that day. And it's all over the place and you have appointments. Oh, sorry, can't work with you. And what happens is that it's a poor experience for everyone, a poor experience for the rep, poor experience for you versus saying, hey, we're going to hammer this thing out in 3 days. And I'm going to determine if you're going to be on my team or not. Mm. And that's where I had the whole paradigm shift is that we're not recruiting. So with top of funnel, you're always recruiting your buddies, your network, things like that, right? But a majority of the people that you want to be building your team with are going to be fresh people that have no exposure to the industry at all levels of the industry, right? Whether they're 19, 20 years old or they're 40, and they're intrigued by the opportunity in solar, right? Mm. Renewable energy. We're going to go from, you know, 2.5 million homes to 14 million over the next 9 years. Like you want to be a part of an industry that's growing this fast, right? Mm-hmm. Now, are you the right company? Great. Yeah. There's a lot of teams here at Legacy. There's a lot of teams at some of these companies, right? But how do you know if you're going to be on the right team? Because you could be at Valor and get all the training you want, or you could be at some podunk team that's just like, hey dude, here's your slicks and go try to figure it out. Right.
Deuces, yeah.
And it's a poor experience. So one of the things, right, is that when you come into training is that I've always said, just systematize it and put everything in place so you don't need to think about it. And what can be evergreen, which is, you know, evergreen's a terminology in marketing, which is, you know, make it once and it's always going to be good. Mm-hmm. You can just repeat and repeat. And so we started figuring out like, look, the attention span inside of a classroom is like 2 hours, maybe three. Like you can only go over so much content before you're overtraining and you're overstimulating and the whole thing. So, you know, I worked with a kid named Chris Garza, which was here with us. And we said, hey, we should create a lot of these decks that you have and the decks that he had. And let's assign homework every single night. And let's measure who's actually watching the homework.
Homework. That's the next level.
Who's watching the homework.
I gotta do homework.
Because then we started saying, okay, so we don't want to recruit people. What we want to do is we are recruiting essentially through the top of funnel, which is gets them excited. It's like the lights, right? And they're the moth. They come in. Perfect. We got you. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to interview you for the job, which I made a lot of mistakes in my career, which was I was recruiting during the interview process. Why we're good and da, 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 da. Mm. And they walk away like, oh, they want me and they need me. Mm. Right. Versus, hey, I'm going to interview you. And then we got really good with the questions and we created this grading system. And, you know, we would bring them in, we would invite them. If we didn't know if we wanted to, we'd bring them to the training. And we had all these sequences to bring them in to get them to show up for day one. This is no different than an appointment, right? You got an appointment, you need to get them to show for the demo, right? It's the same concept when you're getting them into day one training. And then day one training, you set expectations and say, hey, look, guys, you guys have three days to get this all dialed in. On Friday, you're testing out in front of everybody. This is what it's going to look like. I have 15 of you in here. I only have 7 trainers. So we're only taking 7 people, the best of the best. That's right. Good. And so we created all of this takeaway. This is no different than the sales process, but they need it. They need it and we need it because the reality is we want to take on 20 guys, but do you have 20 people to go train?
No, that's a huge mistake too.
It's a huge mistake and it happens over and over, but what a great problem to have. Hey guys, we have 20 people. We're only taking 7, but you can come back for tryouts next time if you want. Mm. Right?
I need to implement that immediately.
Yes. And so there's a lot of different ways to do this. And this really falls on local leadership to implement this and to see things through long-term to actually see results. But the thing was that, you know, we would say something day one, like, hey, you got to have 90% of this pitch memorized tomorrow, just don't show up. Mm-hmm. And they would show up. And the first thing we do, hey, I want to hear everybody's role play. Mm-hmm. And I want to hear everybody's pitch. And you can
start instituting that.
Yeah. And then you pull them aside and, hey man, look, I'm going to give you another day because you're going to get 3 rebuttals today to overcome objections. And then the next thing you're going to need another 3. And there's a lot of memorization. And Chris Garza taught me the memorize, internalize, and personalize, right? This is our job is to get them through these 3 steps in the first week and get them prepared to start producing day one, which is on Saturday. Mm-hmm. That is the main focus. And creating and gamifying it so that leaders are fighting over these setters and they want the setters and so forth. But that's where the money is made. The money is made in that training because if you do that effectively throughout that first week, you don't have to babysit weeks 2, week 3, week 4, because week 2 is also very important. Week 2 is when you start engaging them into the program, right? Because now this is where you lose most of your people. So it's important that the people that you pair them up with are not contradicting the training. So you need to pull them in. You need to be organized. Don't be the guy that's, you know, day of shadow being like, oh, are you available? Are you available? Like that. Imagine being in that dude's shoes.
Yeah.
How you would feel.
Tough. We've all done it.
But they're also interviewing us.
Yeah,
and this is all from experience myself. And so one of the main things is going into week 2 is this is when you have to have that team event every week, because now you're getting them to the team event. You're getting to the sales meeting. Maybe you run a special competition. Maybe you pair them against another team that's going on, but you got to get them fully immersed in the program week 2. And I learned this from Alarms. This is what they did in Alarms, which is like, hey, your first 4 weeks, you can win all this swag, because they knew the stat that if you
it makes it real if they can go get a deal.
It is. And there's a lot of ways to do that in the first week, which is, you require them to bring an electric bill so that you can review it for training purposes. Hey, find somebody that owns a home, bring the bill in. Step 2 is, cool, now we reviewed the bill. Now set an appointment up so that you can see what this looks like inside the home so you have more experience.
You mentioned this, so run a comp on who can bring a bill.
Yeah.
Like that's, dude, I'm just sitting here spinning out. Like I'm like, oh man, it's because we run into the problem of, in a good way, this is why I love this stuff. It's like, I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, if we have 6 people start next week and we have 4 trainers, we tell all 6 of them, only 4 of you are going to make it, instead of like overburdening. Cause you know, I'm guilty of it. I'm sure everybody is, but my guys are guilty of it. I see them do it. They'll be like, well, we want all 6 of them. So maybe we'll just double these 2 guys up. And it's such a poor experience. Instead of like, you gamify it, create a situation where like, okay, if you don't, whoever knows their pitch is staying, whoever doesn't. Whoever memorizes the objection, staying, whoever doesn't. And then you create a grading system, and then you got 4 people who can take somebody on, and then you can gamify that and say like, okay, these 2 people both scored a 5. And these 2 people are both 3s. And then you can pit the managers on like who gets to pick the top draft. Like so much fun stuff in here.
Yeah, there is. I learned that from Robbie over, he was running the Phoenix offices for us, and he implemented that. I was like, that's such a genius idea. Like,
that's pretty genius.
You know, because you know, you can get not only you can get your leadership to be like, hey dude, these are the metrics we're looking for. You know, for you to be first round picks, there's always that one dude that's always really good, or that lady, right? They're always really good. And so you want them. And so you create that competitive force around it, competition around it. I mean, but yeah, no, it's really important. And that is, you have to, because they are taking so many chances. Mm. Like I was lucky enough to be around Oscar. He was a beast. I could knock with him. Like first door I knocked, I just like froze and he sold it. And I was like, oh wow. Like, I would have lost this, but he sold it. And so like being able to see that, it was so good. I got really lucky. Yeah. Right. Are you that person to somebody? Mm. Right. Yeah. That's what's key, because a lot of times it's 100% commission. They could go work any, you know, 9-to-5 job, whether it's at Zoomies or Tilly's, whatever the case is, or working at a pool, but they're taking a risk on this because they see the opportunity, but they need leadership to step up and put them into a process. And managing people doesn't work. You have to manage the system. So create the system. And I always say, if you just do 50% of what we're talking about here, you're gonna have a lot more success, and just try to get better every class and customize it to how it works with you, your leadership, working with your market, because every market's different, right? But it's so important to have a system in place than having no system at all. But treating them as if they were your best friend coming in, and they just took a real big gamble. Like they left a really good paying job and they took a risk on it. Like, what type of effort would you put into that guy? And you need to put that same effort into every single person that comes through, because you'd be surprised on who's actually going to be that next person that ends up being the connector. That was one kid named Ruben for us in the Inland Empire office. We found him at a job fair, and he came in and he was running through one of my trainings, and he pulled me away like on day 3 training. He's like, bro, this is the best thing I've ever been a part of. He's like, can I bring more people to your next training? And I was like, yeah. We ended up recruiting like the entire company that he was at.
Wow.
Because that's when I realized that the training is your largest asset, because whoever can train the best, word gets out.
Well, you're training a marketing force.
Yeah.
We're almost at a minute 30. So we could So I'm going to give a little bit of the secret sauce away because I want people to be able to contact you. And I know that you'll be linked in the Instagram. So you, guys, if you want some advice on any of this stuff, Pete's an amazing human being. Whatever company you're with, you can always reach out to Pete and he'll give you some advice. Really top of the funnel is getting people in. The middle of the funnel is the recruiting process. And then the bottom of the funnel, what Pete has really helped, well, all three portions, but where I really made some big changes was in creating decks for, you know, the people in my office to do Solar School off of. We went from Solar School twice a week, 1 hour a day, to Solar School 4 days a week, 2 hours a day. And then we, you know, review everybody the next week. We'll have them kind of come back in. And I'm still picking up game from you. So a lot of like what you're talking about, I'm still like instituting. I feel like I'm just in the infancies of this, you know, philosophy of training my marketing force better. But if anybody wants to reach out to Pete, he's on Instagram, just a fire hose of like super dope information. You have so much good information on this and the systems and processes that I wish we had more time. But I don't want to give all your secret sauce away.
Yeah, sure.
But you know, thank you for coming on today, man. And being, you know, open with, the community. I think that, you know, a lot of us struggle with the same things. Recruiting, right? It's like, it's this, you know, I've said it, like, I'm a beast, dude. Put somebody in front of my face. You know, my guys say the same thing now. I'm like, why am I the only one bringing people into the office? Right. 'Cause your little power circle's done. And it's, you know, I have more influence and I joke with them, but it's like, you know, what I really realize is the power that I have is, you know, probably the best recruiter in the room, but that means that I'm not using my warm circle anymore. I'm not using my sphere of influence anymore. I've outsourced that into any mechanism, advertising people, humans that I can get people into me on a consistent basis. But where we were really messing up and even just hearing you, like I do try and, you know, be the light and have people, the moth. I'm not like, hey, come make a bunch of money. That's not my pitch in recruiting anymore. But just that training, man, has like watching and then watching my people adapt to it and then watching the people go through it and watching my people make mistakes. I had to pull a guy off the board, you know, and he's in my office. He'll probably laugh, but he was explaining the mathematics of a solar deal to setters. And I'm like, dude,
don't do that.
They just need to know how much they get paid. If they're going to make $1,000 a kilowatt, show them what a dollar looks like, how it turns into 1,000, sell from here, go to here. That's how you get paid. Make 40% of that. You get paid on Wednesdays. Done. Like show them where to find their paycheck in grid. Like, you know, and that's some of the other stuff. We go through full onboarding now. We start with what you said. It's why solar, why legacy? And I thought when I first heard you say this, that's dumb. I'm not going to do that part. And then I thought about it and it's like, no, that's brilliant because I'm getting them re-bought into the industry, the why solar and then the why legacy back in solar school. So they're re-bought in. Then my next deck is like tech deck. Do you got your email? You know where to find your paycheck? You know how to log into Canvas? Are you into grid? You know where Legacy University is? Like showing them all that instead of me just thinking the person training them that week's going to do it because they don't.
And then
4 weeks later, they're like, why haven't I got paid on an M1? And you're like, what do you mean? Go look on grid and find what's grid? Where's my paycheck? You're like, oh man. So it's like just systematizing and creating these processes immediately helped my office. So, thank you for coming on, brother.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
It's been dope. Yeah. Anybody wants to find Pete, he'll be linked in the, Instagram. His tag will be on there. Thanks again, man.
Appreciate it. Likewise, man.
Awesome.